Welcome to Worlds Apart. The conflict in Ukraine may still be dominating international airwaves, but it's not the only and perhaps not the worst calamity in the world today. Sri Lanka is currently going through the most dire economic and political crisis in its history, and there are fears that more nations may go down the same turbulent path as the global economy continues to falter. How contagious it is? Well, to discuss that, I'm now joined from Colombo by Ahilan Kadirgamar, political economist and senior lecturer at the University of Jaffna. Dr. Kadirgamar, it's great to talk to you. Thank you very much for your time.
Thank you for having me.
Now, we are not fully done with the COVID pandemic yet, but there is another malaise seems to be spreading around the world. I'm talking about economic and social instability, and your country, Sri Lanka, seems to be among the first ones affected. On a scale of 1 to 10, how bad it is?
This is by far the worst economic and political crisis Sri Lanka is facing since its independence in 1948. Supplies of all kinds of essential goods from petrol and diesel, cooking gas, medicines, and even foodstuff are in short supply. And the price of many of these goods have doubled or tripled, making it unaffordable for people. So by far, it's the worst economic crisis. And this has led to a political crisis of legitimacy in the country. There are widespread calls now for the resignation of the president himself. His brother, the prime minister, and the entire cabinet resigned. We've had a new government, but it continues to be unstable. There have been protests out on the streets, and this is perhaps the most formidable protest we've seen since 1953, a few years after independence, when Sri Lanka went through a balance of payment crisis, and they tried to raise the price of rice from 25 cents a measure to 70 cents a measure. That crisis was so severe that our cabinet had to meet on a British warship, and the prime minister resigned. So it's very similar to that. And so these are very difficult and worrying times in Sri Lanka, and certainly things are going to change. We cannot go in the direction that we have been.
Dr. Kadirgamar, you mentioned before that there is a very peculiar way in which authoritarianism and neoliberalism combine to push Sri Lanka off the financial and economic cliff. Could you elaborate on that?
Yeah, while the current crisis is partly caused by the global hikes in fuel prices and commodity prices, and certainly the pandemic and its disruption, where Sri Lanka has been dependent on tourism, has led to a fall in foreign reserves. The real issue is much longer. Sri Lanka was the first country in South Asia to liberalize its economy back in 1977, when the Jayawardena government at that time took Sri Lanka away from the non-aligned movement to the orbit of the United States, and with the support of multilateral organizations, structural adjustment, set us on the neoliberal path with trade liberalization and financial liberalization, leading us to become more dependent on international markets. But those reforms could not be sustained because of a long civil war that was started in 1983, lasting 26 years. So it is really with the end of the civil war in 2009, that what I have characterized as a second wave of neoliberalism, when the Mahinda Rajapaksa government at that time, which had won the war with a very authoritarian militarized hold, decided to take neoliberal policies forward. So they went and borrowed extensively in the international capital markets in particular, and invested in infrastructure and tourism. But there were no returns from those investments. And it is those foreign debt in the form of sovereign bonds over the last 13 years that has led to a debt crisis and now this full-blown economic crisis in Sri Lanka.
Now, as you mentioned, many Sri Lankans are putting the blame for the current crisis on the Rajapaksa clan. But given the multitude of factors that you just mentioned, do you think it's fair to make them the only ones responsible? And perhaps a secondary question to that, given how many Rajapaksa family members there are in power, do you think at the end this nepotism paid well for them? Because they couldn't be oblivious to how the public would react to so many family members being in power. Why do you think the president felt the need to appoint or have so many of his relatives in the positions of power?
In a way, it is the arrogance of power. They have been in power from 2005 to 2015. And after they won the war, they thought they were invincible. And they decided to bring more and more family members in. And they thought with a combination of Sinhala Buddhist nationalism and militarization and this kind of financialization that they could be in power for a while. Now, more recently, when they again came back to power in 2019, soon after that, the pandemic hit us, and it was obvious to many of us that we were headed towards an economic crisis. But they did very little to address it. In fact, they continued with the same policies, and they tried to just keep their political cronies happy. And that is why there is so much anger against them. Even though this is a historic crisis, this is going to be long drawn out, and even if a government changes, it's going to be very difficult to address this crisis. They did very little and completely mismanaged the economy. So much of the public anger, at the moment at least, is against them.
It's very interesting to contrast what's happening in Sri Lanka to the recent elections in the Philippines, where, you know, not just one, but two political dynasties remained or returned to power. And many experts attribute that to the weakness of political parties in the Philippines, which gives political families, political clans, more authority, more power. Sort of, they become sort of political brands. I wonder what's the dynamic in Sri Lanka? How does it work there?
Here, what we have seen over the last 5-6 years is actually a lot of change within political parties. The what's called the grand old party here, the United National Party, to whom the British handed over power in 1948, has been reduced to just one seat in parliament in the last elections. And in fact, that leader of the party, who even lost his seat, has been appointed as prime minister a month ago by this very delegitimized president. The Rajapaksas, in turn, 4 years ago, launched their own party, the SLPP, breaking away from another age-old party, the Sri Lanka Freedom Party. So there's constant changes going on in the political realm. I see that as linked to the economic unraveling that has also been long in the making. Of course, we focus on very recent events, but economically and politically, Sri Lanka has been going through change, but all of those have been coming into a major crisis that has erupted. But I also think this is going to be a long drawn out crisis where it's going to take years for us to gain economic and political stability. And in the years ahead, we might see other nationalist forces enter the realm. So it can be also a very dangerous period going forward.
Now, as dramatic as the situation is in Sri Lanka, we are also observing similar trends in many other countries around the world. The prices of food, the prices of fuel are rising pretty much everywhere, even in the developed countries. I wonder how much has the state of the global economy influenced what's going on in your country? What's the share of the sort of globalized influence on the domestic affairs there?
Historically, you know, an island nation like us, we have always been influenced by historical developments. You know, the Great Depression of the 1930s, and I'm actually characterizing the economic crisis in Sri Lanka now as another depression. The Great Depression led to policies in Sri Lanka of free education, free healthcare, food subsidies. And to this day, some of that survive. I teach in a university, all universities in Sri Lanka are state universities, and we have free education up to university. And so the Great Depression, even though it was a global phenomena, ended up creating a welfare state in Sri Lanka. Similarly, the crisis of the 1970s, you would know that, you know, global oil prices quadrupled with the OPEC oil shock in the 1970s, the global downturn. And Sri Lanka was one of the first countries, maybe after Chile, under the, you know, after the military coup and fascist rule of Pinochet, that turned to neoliberal reforms. So similarly, I see the current crisis in Sri Lanka as a continuation of the global financial crisis of 2008, which really hasn't been resolved. We have only been trying to financialize and bubble up our economy. And what I see as perhaps a crisis of neoliberalism hitting Sri Lanka first. So I don't think the usual solution is going to work. We are going to have to drastically change direction if we are to come out of this crisis.
Now, Dr. Kadir Gamar, whenever we talk about the crisis in the global economy, it's always hard to understand where to start and where to finish. Some economists blame it on the very nature of capitalism. Others explain it more narrowly by the consequences of the COVID pandemic and the disruption in production chains. I wonder, where do you stand on that as far as the global economic mess is concerned? What are the antecedents there?
Yeah, no, as I mentioned, the 1930s, the 1970s, capitalism periodically goes through these crises because it runs on the profit motive. And so this is, for me, very much a capitalist crisis. But we are also in this latest phase of capitalism called neoliberalism. We have seen repeated crises. So we've seen crises in Latin America in the 1980s, the East Asian crises of 1997, 98, even the crisis in Russia in the 1990s. And then, of course, it hit the Western world. Until it hit the Western world, we were told that it's only crony capitalism that leads to crises. But they didn't talk about crony capitalism when it became the global financial crisis of 2008. So it's not about crony capitalism. It is something inherent to capitalism. And this is what I think we are seeing happen now. So this, and so the crises have become more deeper and more frequent. Mm-hmm. But this time, I see it as actually a crisis of neoliberalism itself, that to be able to continue with accumulation through dispossession, where finance capital has been able to continue to accumulate at the cost of working people all around the world. And the third world in particular has been really hit hard by it. It affects people's daily lives, as we are seeing in Sri Lanka. And even in Sri Lanka, since the 1970s, inequality has been greatly rising. And part of the anger out on the street is also reflecting those dynamics of neoliberalism.
Well, Dr. Kadir Gamar, we have to take a short break now, but we will be back in just a few moments. Stay tuned. Welcome back to Worlds Apart with Akhil Kadir-Gamar, political economist and senior lecturer at the University of Jaffna. Dr. Kadir-Gamar, before the break, we were discussing the origins of the Sri Lankan crisis as well as of the global economic crisis. And while it's natural and I think logical to blame it on the sitting government, I wonder if there are any internationally accepted economic dogmas that various governments feel obliged to comply with, but that simply don't work anymore. Is the global economy or our national economies still function according to the laws and the rules that are taught at the departments of economics?
No, I think what we have seen that whether it's economics departments in my country or in much of the world, they are unable to either predict or provide viable solutions and ways forward to the economic crises that we are seeing. In fact, they believe that markets clear, that markets themselves will solve these problems. And that ideology is also behind the policies that are recommended and put forward and forced even on many third world countries by the International Monetary Fund and the World Bank and the neoliberal institutions. So, but they seem to have very little disregard for the real abject human suffering that is caused by those policies. So this is a global phenomena. I think Sri Lanka is one of the first countries in this wave to even default on its international debt to go through a severe crisis. The Sri Lankan elite are looking to the IMF to solve this problem. Sri Lanka is in a desperate situation now. You know, we have to go around with a begging bowl to any country that would give us credit lines or any institution that would give us a credit line to import essentials.
I'm sorry for interrupting. It's one thing when you turn to your neighbors who may or may not give you some support in the times of need. But if I'm not mistaken, Sri Lanka went to the IMF 16 times over the last 12 or 13 years. You've been borrowing a huge amount of money at very significant interest rate. And from what I've seen, even the opposition at this point of time, while they're calling for the resignation of the current government, they're still insisting on pretty much repeating the same economic policy. So is that going to bring a different result?
I don't think so, and not in the medium term for sure, because since 1965, as you mentioned, Sri Lanka has gone through 16 IMF agreements. More recently, after the war in 2009, we went into one, and then in 2016, after a change of government. So every government has used the same approach, and going to the IMF only allowed us to borrow more and at higher interest rates, so pushing us further into debt. So it only bubbles us up for a few years and then we collapse into the debt trap. So that's obviously not the solution. But this has become the global approach to solve the problems of debt-ridden countries around the world. And it's not just Sri Lanka this time, I think. A number of other countries are likely to default or get into a similar kind of problem. Already we can see Pakistan is in a crisis. Nepal's economy in terms of South Asia is on shaky ground. So we need an alternate, different direction. And during these kinds of global crises, and it can be very painful in terms of how that change happens, there is also a change in the global order. Mm-hmm. I mentioned the Great Depression of the 1930s, and out of that, of course, there was the rise of fascism, a Second World War, and huge changes before the global order changed to a kind of a Keynesian approach of social welfare states. Again, the 1970s, a time of many proxy wars around the world, and then a change, a consolidation of a neoliberal project with finance capital rising up. So this might again be a time, and the worry is that these kinds of great crisis, as the great political economist Giovanni Arrighi has mentioned, lead to great unraveling, which can also have serious political and economic consequences, and that can also lead to huge amount of destruction. And it's a worry for all of us, I think, who want a peaceful world.
Now, speaking about potential alternatives for Sri Lanka, if I'm not mistaken, India has extended almost $3 billion to your country in credit lines and various other instruments since January this year. That's a huge amount of money. It's more than the United States or China have offered you. Could that potentially be an alternative to the IMF route?
Well, I think India has itself is saying that it has reached its limits of providing a credit line. So Sri Lanka needs to get credit from various actors, but it also needs to create its own system. In the short term, we have no option, but we need to prioritize our imports. We've been living well beyond our means. We've been importing luxury items. And even today, that is continuing in a small way. So we need to prioritize our system. We need to create a public distribution system where the state takes responsibility during such a severe crisis. But even now, I really think the market should address it. And the IMF recommendations are also for the market to fix this problem. Now, some analysts think that going to the IMF would bring about international credibility, that Sri Lanka can again go and borrow in the international markets. I think that's far-fetched. We can see global interest rates rising, and there'll be very little appetite for global capital to come into a country like Sri Lanka, particularly after it has defaulted. So I'm seeing Sri Lanka sort of muddle along, chug along into a long drawn-out crisis. But that clarity isn't there with our elite or our policymakers. Ultimately, Sri Lankans have to make a decision on what kind of an economy we want to build, and do we want to continue to be dependent on certain international actors, or do we want to chart our own path?
And I also want to mention, it may be very presumptuous of me, but I think Russia provides a good example of being able to win itself off the IMF financing at the time when it was really desperate after the collapse of the Soviet Union. We had huge debt. We were paying huge interest rates, but over time we've been able to become more self-sufficient, which leads me to my next question. One of the features of the current crisis is the shortage of foreign exchange currencies that left you unable to import. And I'm talking not only about luxury items that you mentioned, but also medicine. I know that Sri Lanka has been experiencing difficulties with electricity. As painful as this experience may be, don't you think that's also a good argument for self-sufficiency, actually building enough industry, enough economy to live within your own means?
Absolutely. In fact, last year, a colleague of mine and I published a paper in the International Quarterly of Asian Studies where they were looking at the long 1960s in many Asian countries where our emphasis was on self-sufficiency. We were headed into that kind of an experiment in the 1970s before we switched to a sort of a neoliberal direction. And self-sufficiency, industrial policy, these all became bad terms, bad concepts for a neoliberal outlook. But I think we need to think about self-sufficiency. We need to think about our own sort of agrarian question and how we're going to become self-sufficient in food in particular. We are going through a food crisis, and to slowly start on manufacturing. So that has to be a long-term direction. Now, of course, Sri Lanka also has its limitations. You mentioned Russia in the 1990s. Even Malaysia during the 1997 crisis did not go for an IMF agreement. But I think Malaysia or Russia have much more natural resources than a country like Sri Lanka. We don't have oil reserves, for example. So we are dependent in the international global economy, but we have to set it on our own terms. And we really have to think about our own social structure, the importance of equality and freedom within our country to be able to chart that. I think our intellectuals, our visionary leaders, maybe in a different age in the 1940s, 50s, and 60s thought in that direction. But now we have what I would characterize as a comprador elite who have become very much more dependent on the West and don't think in those terms.
Now, Changing gears a little bit, I want to bring some of my professional experience. In the past, I covered a lot of Arab Spring uprisings. And when I look at what's happening on the streets of Sri Lanka right now, I feel this, I have this feeling of deja vu, people taking to the streets, demanding more dignity, demanding more freedom, demanding more accountability from their governments. And when I saw that happening in Cairo, in Damascus, in Tripoli, you know, it had a good feeling to it. And people on those streets always thought that, you know, things couldn't possibly get worse. And yet history, unfortunately, proved that it could get worse. Now, I know that Sri Lanka had a very painful experience of civil strife. You went through decades-long civil war. Aren't you afraid of its return? Because it all starts with the rallies. And some of the rallies in Sri Lanka have already been militarized. Aren't you afraid of it disintegrating into something far more precarious and dangerous?
Yeah, Sri Lanka, you know, went through a civil war mainly in the north and east in Jaffna, where I teach. That was the stronghold of the Tamil Tigers when the civil war started. But there were also two large insurrections in the south by Sinhala youth. So we have that history, but at the same time, the current protests, even though on one day when peaceful protesters were attacked by government goons, it did turn violent in reprisals. For the most part, it has been peaceful, and we don't have any kind of a movement taking it in a violent direction. But my worry is that right now, even these protests have been much more inclusive of minorities and so on. But if there isn't a solution provided, if IMF conditionalities lead to further suffering, maybe 2 years down the line, there's a danger that another a nationalist, fascist type of regime could try to capture people's grievances. And that could again tear apart our society. So not maybe immediately, but if we don't address these problems now, Sri Lanka has a history of the pendulum swinging politically from one direction to the other. So we really have to use this moment very carefully to put Sri Lanka on a sustainable path, where first to address the food crisis and the immediate needs of the people, and then the unemployment, the loss of livelihoods, so that people feel, you know, begin to have confidence in the economy. And for all of that, we need a new leadership. We need a new leadership from the ground up. And it's going to take time. You know, Greece lost almost a decade with its economic crisis. I think there were something like 7 prime ministerial changes that happened in that decade in the 2010s. We might be also looking at something like that in Sri Lanka over the next few years.
Well, Dr. Kadir Gamar, as you mentioned, Sri Lanka tends to be among the pioneers in contracting the crisis. I certainly hope that you will also be among the first in finding the solution. Wish you all the best to you and your people.
Thank you for having me, and thank you for your concern about Sri Lanka.
And thank you for watching. Hope to see you again on Worlds Apart. We'll be right back.